From a secret location somewhere in America, this is your Chill Pack
Hollywood.
Hollywood Hour.
I'm leaving.
Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Welcome to Let's Do Talkin'. I'm your co-host, Phil Lairness, and this is the star of the show, Mr. Dean Haglund. Hello, Dean Haglund.
Star? What are we talking about? I believe it's all duties are actually you handle all the duties.
Exactly, and you're the star. Isn't that the job? I mean, that's the job. The star should just be in his trailer and relaxing and resting and getting ready to bring the funny. And
oh, wait, I'm supposed to bring the funny to this?
You know, I we'll get to where you are in a minute, but you are, from the sounds of it, wrestling a leather couch.
Oh, yes, I'm on a leather easy chair. Should I get off that?
Just you're really showing that chair who's boss is what it sounds like.
Oh, my God, I shifted sideways as the excitement started. That we were recording.
The excitement. Let's do talking. Oh my goodness. Maybe
more excitement than ever.
Oh my goodness. You know, our show actually might get better ratings. I don't know what ratings even mean when it comes to a soundcast, but I think our audience size would grow if the name of this show was Let's Do Talking.
Well, you know, it's never too late to change after 10 years.
Chill Pack Hollywood. We could still have Chill Pack Hollywood Hour presents. Let's do talking.
I like it.
Dean Haglund, we played the John K. Steele introduced opening that says from a secret location somewhere in America. And I think that fits because although, I guess, colloquially, when we say America, everybody assumes that one means the United States of America, but that again is so provincial because the United States of America is not America, right? All of the continents of North and South America are part of the Americas, are they not?
That is correct, because as Americus Vespucci said long before we drew borders... was that the guy's name? I'm a little foggy.
I always get confused between America Vespucci and America Ferrara. I always get those two brilliant performers confused. Anyway, the point is you are safely ensconced somewhere in North America and really just barely, barely across the border from the United States in a part of Canada that at least has to be considered kind of halfway part of the United States, given that so much of our beloved American entertainment comes from there.
That's correct. You are referring to I'm in Vancouver at the moment. My old hometown, my university town where I, in fact, I went back to the very theater I started at. Not the very theater, the very theater company, the Vancouver Theater Sports League. I played there on a Friday night with some of the old alumni and some of the great new talent there, and had a blast.
Well, so, that's cool. So you've been there a few days now, and yes, I mean, college, you went to Simon Fraser University. You came up through the ranks of theater sports. You did comedy. You acted. You lived there for many years, more than a decade. How long did you live, at least on and off, how long did you live there in Vancouver?
Over 15 years.
Yes.
I was doing the math, actually, walking these streets recently. So, I was here for Expo 86, the Giant World's Fair, which I don't think they even do anymore. Do they do those?
So you've spent, I'm just realizing now that means, as a full-time resident of Los Angeles, you probably spent just about as much time as you did in Vancouver prior to moving to Sydney.
Yeah, I think I just crossed the mark in Los Angeles, living there longer than I lived in Vancouver. But then suddenly up and moved to Australia. And so, you know, now the clock ticks over. We start again on how many years we put into town.
I guess we can say that the reason behind your visit to Vancouver and certainly, you know, big news in the world of television when a beloved, beloved series gets revived after so many years. And I think the anticipation is building, the eagerness, the hunger for new episodes certainly growing to a fever pitch. And the show I'm referring to, of course, is Will and Grace, which returns to NBC this fall. Where was I when that announcement? I guess that announcement got made in January of last year about Will and Grace. And I just found out this week when I saw a commercial for it. Yeah, I didn't have any idea.
Oh, my God. And they've been doing, they got the hilarious promo where Eric McCormick and Deborah Messing are leaving a pitch, and then it's a whole musical number. It's like a 5-minute musical number about returning to Will and Grace. I don't know if you've seen that online. That's hilarious.
The pejorative response that I've gotten from a lot of people is, well, none of them are really doing much. And I don't know if that's true, but boy,
I don't think that's true.
The economics behind bringing these shows back, you know, not, I mean, this is a big deal because, like the X-Files revival, which was on its native network, I guess we can say, on Fox.
Mm-hmm.
Will and Grace revival will be on its native network, NBC, whereas most of these revivals, Arrested Development, Gilmore Girls, Fuller House, are going to Netflix, are going to streaming platforms. And we have to assume a financial model that makes sense for them, though, of course, they never reveal their viewership numbers. But those people are smart. They're in business to make money and to stay in business, and they're continually expanding and growing. So we must assume that when they pick those shows up and then renew them for further seasons of the revival, that they're financially hitting their mark. But it is stunning. On the one hand, given how expensive not only hit shows become, but how expensive revivals of hit shows must be, that networks and the production companies can afford them.
I think there's two things involved. A, I'm not 100% sure they started the salary they ended with. I think there might be a reset on star salaries, which... and producer salaries and stuff like that on revivals. I'm not 100% sure. The other thing I know for a fact is marketing startup cost on a new show is the equivalent of almost paying for a new show. So if you already have a marketing hook a la here's a revival of a show you loved, of actors you enjoyed, of storylines and characters you have come to know and are in your psyche, you can save whatever the expense is on, you know, paying the salaries you paid last time by not having to do an entire marketing blitz all over again, particularly in this crowded, multi-leveled, platformed rollout that you have to do nowadays, as opposed to just buying a couple newspaper ads and then putting up a billboard here and there.
I also would point out that obviously at the heart of this is the fact that television has changed so dramatically and no longer, you know, I was having this conversation yesterday about the pressure one can feel to stay au courant in contemporary cultural landscape when audience size is so fragmented that how do you know what you're supposed to be watching? Because there are no shows really anymore, for the most part, that are both moving the needle of cultural conversation and drawing a big audience. It's so fragmented. And the same is true of movies as well. So it can become almost stressful to think that you have to keep up. Gone are the days that were somewhat comforting, where you knew all the shows that anyone was going to talk about because 20 to 30 million people were watching them each week. And you might try them out. And if you didn't like it, well, at least you could feel good about yourself for knowing what the show is and knowing you don't like it. But instead of it coming up in conversation and not knowing anything about it, like me not knowing Will and Grace was returning. But the networks are desperate to get back to this era of larger audience size. And so I would think, look at, for example, the X-Files revival. I was not misled, but I was mistakenly looking at what the audience size was compared to what the audience size was, let's say, when it left, and trying to do the math on, well, how many of these people are returning fans? Are there any new fans? How do we find this out? But really, the only math that matters is it was the third most watched scripted television show of that year. What do the numbers matter when you've got the third most? And so getting back to your paradigm about how much a startup show costs, just the marketing costs alone, there's also the fact that you bring this back, you know you have a show that is going to exceed in numbers all but maybe one or two extant shows. And if you knew that going into startup shows, wouldn't it make the cost far more worth it? So it's it's fascinating time.
And and then you could also set your price per 30 seconds at a higher rate and cover your studio costs and all that. So
of course we're gonna quickly run out of shows from the 90s, which was really the last era where shows did derive this kind of audience, or the early 2000s. Right. We're quickly gonna run out of those shows that we can revive. So this isn't going to be the future of television, reviving these things, because we're not gonna revive shows that drew an average of 1.5 million each week.
Right. I know. I can't imagine Remington Steele coming back.
Don't kid yourself. See, Remington Steele, but see, it's too old now. That's the point. But Remington Steele was in that era where, as a top 30 television show, would probably be, again, now the second or the third most scripted, watched scripted show, if it even had half of its audience. So it's, I mean, as we've talked about before, the viewership size of The Lone Gunman, when it got canceled, was a viewership size that, never mind now, within 5 or 6 years was a viewership size that Fox would have killed for.
Yeah, I know. So,
and of course, there's some things at play there where it wasn't viewership size alone, or even maybe mostly responsible for the canceling of that show, as you cover, tongue in cheek, but you cover somewhat in your comic book, Why the Lone Gunmen Were Canceled. Now,
which is available, by the way, in 2 weeks on my website in digital format.
Oh, that's exciting.
That's exciting.
DeanHagland.com. If only we could make The Truth Is Out There available on your website.
Okay, once I'm finished here in Vancouver, I'm going to snap it on that.
Okay, that's excellent. We'll let people know about that on next week's show. Now, you are in Vancouver, and you're there in addition to doing a big theater sports show. You're there to do some of the acting that the kids love.
Some of the acting that the kids enjoy.
And it pertains to a show that we were talking about, not Will and Grace.
That's right. I'm not here doing Will and Grace, because I believe they're shooting that in Los Angeles.
And you are, are we allowed to say what the name of the show is that you're doing?
I think so, because I haven't signed anything saying don't say any of it.
We're not going to reveal what you told me, obviously. We're not going to spoil anything. But yes, you're there doing season 11 of The X-Files. As Langley, I think that's fair enough to say as Langley. They're not bringing you in to do, you're not an alien bounty hunter, you're not. I'm going to throw this out, people. It's not a dream sequence or a peyote-esque vision either. So
very good.
It is not something that ought to, although in this day and age, who knows, but it should not be something that ought to inspire grief stricken filled messages sent to Dean about how he was not used enough in a show, a show that he has no power over at all. So we should save those emails under any circumstance.
I was enjoying the wrath filled messages going, it's nice to have passionate fans that really wished I had more power and more screen time.
Yeah.
It's like, yes, I support that fully.
So anyway, it's an idea that seems very intriguing, and an idea very close to one that we have discussed from time to time as a potential for exploring future adventures of our beloved computer hacking trio known as the Lone Gunman. So very exciting, and maybe we'll hit people to more as the weeks go on and as the dates approach, and as we find out whether or not there are more trips to Vancouver on the horizon for you. But
you know, those are 14-hour flights.
Are we allowed to say who wrote and directed the episode you're doing?
Ooh, I don't know about that.
Okay, all right.
Let's save that once I've signed a piece of paper.
Because it is very cool, very exciting. And I'll want to, if you're allowed to, I would very much like to get the chance to ask you about this person's process and what makes them unique. Because certainly a very unique voice. So anyway, much to look forward to. But we have a lot to get to, and I don't want to focus too much on any one thing, but you know, terrorism, Finland, a terrorist attack, European attacks, but we haven't had a chance to discuss what went on in Charlottesville last weekend,
right?
And the responses of this week, the utter chaos politically that seems to be taking place. So I thought we could have a little stream of consciousness in the wake of the week, touching on such topics as the alt-right, free speech, anti-fascist groups, hate groups, the blame game, credible messengers, violence, the Civil War, Robert E. Lee, statues, lying, and more. We'll make it a little bit of a game show. Pick a topic, Dean.
Did you set Garrett Watley to do a little musical sting for this segment? Because it seems to be happening every week.
Oh, my God. What would we call it? I don't know.
I don't know. It's so hard to figure out, right? Because
Stumped on Trump will be the name of, I don't know.
Stumped on Trump. Well, and this is, you know, okay, let's start there. Here you have what leadership is about. Mm. It's not about making executive orders. It's not about
policy. It's not even about policy, per se.
It's not even about policy. Yeah. It's a moral echo board, as it were, to say something, however bland. Even George Bush at the 9/11 saying, "Let's go shopping." That was enough just to like set the tone. Right?
Can I make a? I would like to. I rarely compliment President Bush W. I rarely do, but the thing that gets short shrift for me is the fact in the days after 9/11, him visiting that mosque and giving a speech from a mosque about Islam as a religion of love. And we will never know how much blowback that speech might have prevented, how much wrath directed at the Muslim community in this country might have been diffused. We'll never know. That's the thing about this kind of moral leadership. You're saying you can't measure it. There's nothing that can be quantified, and therefore it isn't something you can lead with in polls or in campaigns. Right. But that's the part of the job that is leadership, because it's free from any concept of re-election or driving poll numbers. It's you're doing the right thing because absent that right thing might lead to more pain and suffering.
Absolutely. So you only know it when you don't see it.
So hats off to President Bush for embodying in that moment that kind of leadership. And it's the kind of leadership that was absolutely absent, abrogated by the office of the president this past week.
And that's a fact. I mean, and I think you're pointing out something more, that it's not just it lands on the shoulders of Trump, but the Steve Bannons, everything that's being fired, the tumultuousness of the administration itself and its vacuum and its inability. And there's still.
But this does go back to him. This goes back to him because, I mean,
absolutely.
He makes the first statement. that does not do justice to it, blaming all sides, while not blaming himself. I always love that there's enough blame to go around, but it never reaches the White House. And then 2 days later, he issues the statement that everybody wanted him to make, that he reads clearly reluctantly off cue cards, and he does so only after bragging about his accomplishments with the economy. And what was described in that moment by some really keen observers was this felt like a hostage tape.
Right.
And he was being forced to read it by the people who work with him on a daily basis. And then, of course, the next day, infuriated that he was forced to do the right thing, he then doubled down on the wrong thing and gave aid and comfort to those who seek to express not only hatred, but seek violence and destruction of the very fabric of our peaceful society. And
we talk about tone a lot on this.
Yes.
And, you know, the way the tone of how you give a speech, the imbued emotion behind it, the equivalency to the second day thing that Trump gave was very similar to us in Australia, to Johnny Depp and Amber Heard apologizing to the government about bringing their dogs over. That had the exact same tone in speech reading that made us all kind of both be sad and have a giggle down under.
And like Johnny Depp's dogs, Trump's speech is another dog that would not hunt. And like what I did there. And, you know, the response on those people who always do and always will come to the president's aid. And we are at a time when, again, decency and humanity and morality is suddenly a team sport all of a sudden. And this is the most depressing thing of all, because, and I will preface this by saying that the president may have made points that have a valid place in discussion about race and protest and freedom of speech. He may very well have made points by that. But if your response to people criticizing him abrogating the responsibility of leadership in moments of crisis is to say, yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but, you're part of the problem. There is no yeah, but, when what we're talking about are Nazis and white supremacists. Period.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Period.
And for those people who are freaking out that 61% of Trump supporters polled have said that there is nothing that he could do to lose their support, that number terrified a lot of people this week for some reason. What bothers me is that 72% of that 61%, so 3 out of 4 roughly, are women, which is just such a mind bender to me. But 61% of his supporters say that they will never leave him no matter what. And that seems like a huge figure. He himself bragged on the campaign trail, right, that he could murder someone on Fifth Avenue and his supporters would still love him and still follow him. And there's clearly a point to that maybe being true. But I would like to tell people what that 61% really means. Let's say favorably, generously, his approval rating right now is at 36%. And it may actually be a little bit lower than that. We know that it is a historic low. It achieved a historic low this week for any president in their first term ever. And but let's say it's 36%. Well, if he loses all but that 61%, that brings him down to 22% approval. And here's a trivia question, Dean Haglund. What was Richard Nixon's approval rating when he was forced to resign following impeachment in the wake of Watergate? What was his approval rating when he resigned?
22%?
22%. So what we're talking about is the baseline that any president cannot lose. So let's not worry about it. 78% disapproval. You know, Suicide Squad is one of the shittiest movies ever made.
Yes.
Batman versus Superman is an ungodly abomination on the human race, and it got more than 22% approval, according to Rotten Tomatoes, from critics. So 22% wow. is really, really bad. So let's not worry about that. All right.
Right.
Something else we talk about is not just tone. Tone goes into this, though, I think,
right.
Absolutely. But it's something about being a credible messenger. I alluded to the idea that there might be some points that the president was getting to that are interesting, conversational, food for thought. And
right.
as I always say, one of the important things about freedom of speech is that good ideas can come from anywhere at any time. The worst among us will have insight that can be valuable to the collective. So, of course, the president made some points that are valuable conversational starters, perhaps. Two things, though. Timing is everything. And
yes.
that, yeah, but is inappropriate in the wake of Nazis and white supremacists tearing at the peaceful fabric and lives of our citizenry. The second thing is the second thing is our president has lost all credibility as a messenger. And that's his doing.
Right.
He's responsible for that. No one else.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, when you step up and you talk about how there is there's blame enough for both sides, and pointing out that at least the white supremacists, the nationalists, the Nazis had a permit, as opposed to the counter protesters who had no permit. When in fact, yes, you're right, Mr. President, they didn't have a permit. The counter protesters had two permits, but that lie is allowed to perpetuate for several days. And then he gets into how about in the wake of the Barcelona attack, this story about how General Pershing dealt with Islamic extremists a century ago, a story he loved telling on the campaign trail that has been thoroughly debunked. And I'm talking, I guess, directly to the 61%. Do you know how I know that something is factually wrong? I know it because it's coming out of Trump's mouth. That's how I know it is categorically not factual. So he is not a credible messenger.
However, if
you're not a credible messenger, I don't think there is any getting over that. There is an article that the question is not, will Trump resign? It's that when did he resign? Because he resigned the responsibilities of the office.
Yes, that's true. Well, he didn't know the responsibilities of the office. Clearly, he waltzed his way in. Surprisingly, without actually knowing, because he's a political outsider, he would have no idea what the responsibilities and humanities and all the courses you take at university if you go to political science, which he not only did not know, but purposely rejected as a platform. Got him to a place that he really needs to know these things, and he doesn't.
Do you know what he never had any interest in learning them. I think that's important,
right?
Too.
Yeah, for sure. So, but there, you said something about how do I know it's factual because it came out of his mouth?
Factually incorrect.
Incorrect. This is where the conversation becomes very hard to talk to anybody who is of the 61%, because I know people who are of that, and I would enjoy a conversation to find the middle ground of what their unwavering support is so that I could have some solace and sleep at night to go, okay, these people are not crazy per se, but there is something that they see that I can't see in the support of this guy.
Well,
what is it?
I don't know.
Can I have that conversation?
I think you're making an assumption. You're making an assumption about them not being crazy. And I don't mean that actually pejoratively. Look, let's look at racism itself, right? Just racism.
Right.
We know, we accept as axiom that most bigotry is based on ignorance. Right. And we've learned this throughout history. Harvey Milk was a wonderful example that the reason that there was this Proposition 8 in California was heading to great success, which would have removed the right for gays to hold a job in California, that he knew that this was passing because people didn't believe they knew homosexuals. And so the whole campaign was... what you think you don't know. So the whole campaign was to introduce themselves as, hey, we're your neighbors, we're your butchers, your dentists, your sons, your daughters. And and once they started doing that, a whole lot of people were suddenly no longer ignorant of who homosexuals were. And so a, a big plurality of them shifted their votes in a really a relatively short time. So we know this. We know that most bigotry is based on ignorance. And that which is, and we are all of us are ignorant, as Will Rogers would say, depending on the topics. Depending on the topics. We will always be ignorant sometimes. And we will be bigoted against ideas. We'll be bigoted against policies. We'll be bigoted against TV shows, movies, artists, whatever. And usually it's out of our lack of exposure, our lack of experience with something. So we know that. That's the good news. But the part of it that is not... is then always the result of either idiocy or mental illness. And you have said yourself that there is a mental health epidemic, certainly in this country, maybe globally. I can't speak to that. But people are under such extraordinary, astounding pressure. And as we talked about in The Truth Is Out There, when people feel under attack, then they assume this defensive posture, and we seek out things that will confirm our defensive posture. And down that road leads to a mental illness, not a permanent mental illness. There are certainly ways out of that. But we all, again, behave like this. This is how paranoia starts. And so I would flip the script. Instead of feeling uncomfortable or disappointed that we can't have a meaningful conversation with that base group that will not ever lose their support for the president, now, 10 years from now, it might be a different thing. I would focus on the fact that there are entire groups, like I said, about Democrats and Republicans in the Senate. Maybe starting to talk like they're going to work together to fix healthcare, to handle some other issues that need done. There are entire groups. I saw an interview with Penn Jillette on Bill Maher this weekend, and you know, he's one of the most outspoken libertarians. And he pointed out that his friends who are Democrats, you know, real progressives who are very much in favor, like Gavin Newsom was on the panel. Right, a progressive, very much in favor of activist government, versus Penn Jillette, who's a libertarian who whose attitude is always, let's first exhaust more freedom as the answer before we look to the government for answers on anything. He Penn Jillette pointed out they would have to talk for hours before they disagreed about anything right now. Because we're in such a triage situation. He talked about his friend Glenn Beck, who he always disagrees with on almost every topic. And again, they have nothing they disagree on right now. So we are able to bridge the gap with people and have conversations, meaningful conversations right now, with people that we were not ever able to before. So I would focus on that. A little bit more. The other good news, and we're always looking for the good news, right?
Let's look for good news.
The other good news that Penn Jillette said, he said there's two points. One is these are the good things that have already come out of a Trump presidency already. One, the curbing of presidential power. Congress has already worked to limit a president's power. And isn't that actually a good thing? moving forward. Aren't
yes.
we
yeah.
grateful about that? Checks and balances being restored. A second thing he said is proof that there is no Illuminati, there is no powerful trilateral commission at all. All these secret groups, the Bilderbergers,
right,
all these groups that are supposedly deciding and dictating how the future's going, clearly they have no power. Or
right.
this
yeah.
guy,
even the Davos group,
would
yeah.
never have been put into power, and
that's
and
so
he would
true.
Be gone. He would have had a mysterious yeah. embolism 4 months ago.
The Davos group that meets in Switzerland every year of the richest, powerful business elite. I believe the summation of last year's meeting was we're at a loss to explain populism, that they termed both Brexit, Trump, all of these things. They were at a loss not only to explain it, but how to deal with it. So if we think back to the glory days of the 90s and conspiracy theory and stuff like that, this was always the goal, was to, rise up against these elite business powerful people. And now we're there, and yet it doesn't I'm not saying we go back, but there's a way forward, it seems, is what you're suggesting. That Penn Jillette can see that that comes from a conversation that now we can agree with people that we were not agreeing with
absolutely
as a year ago.
And I want to get to some of these points where I do agree with the people that that I question and I take to task for the inappropriateness of their response, but not
right.
the content of what they're saying. Before I do that, though, can I ask a very fundamental question here? When we're having these rallies about the preservation of white culture, what the hell is white culture? Isn't that and I don't mean pejoratively, but that's a contradiction in terms. White is not a race. White is not a national. I mean, it's not an ethnicity, and it's not a nationality.
Right.
The two things out of which culture identity flow. Are we talking about European culture? Because if so, which European culture? Are we talking about NASCAR?
Caucasian?
NASCAR? Are we talking about Kenny G? Are we talking about Nantucket Reds, those ugly salmon color pants? Because I have witnessed a lot of boring shit white people are into, but the groups into them have nothing in common with any other group of white people. And you know why that is,
right.
Dean? Because there is no
right.
white culture.
Interesting. You're right, because to me, white culture is Minnesota somehow, and farming, and Norwegian.
But that looks a lot different than people going and having picnics around the statues of Robert E. Lee, you know, and watching the NASCAR. Country music. It's a totally different thing, you know. And the reason I bring this up is because the reasonable sounding among the white nationalist, white supremacist, Nazi, KKK, alt-right spokespeople is that we're not expressing hatred towards other groups. We are standing
right.
up for white culture. We are protecting white culture, which is under attack from without. Here's the thing. As I just pointed out, there's no such thing, though, as this
right.
white culture. You can't even show me what it is. You can't explain, which means, you mean a culture without people of color. That's what you're standing up for. And if you're standing up for that, it means you're speaking against all other cultures and all other people of color. That's what you mean.
That's right. Sort of here in Canada for a long time, we said we don't know what Canadian culture is, but we know what it isn't. And what it wasn't was our friends down south of the border. However, Canada has always been a cultural mosaic, which is different than a melting pot.
Right.
We didn't want everyone to blend into one giant thing. We were encouraging everyone to keep whatever they arrived with and place it on the vast board so that when you stood back and looked at it as a whole, it would be this brand new piece of art. And that was a cultural mosaic. And that's been taught to us in our schools from the very get-go. So again, what is Canadian culture? Well, we don't know. We know what it isn't. And I don't know if that is then pertaining to what they're trying to explain white culture is, but then you have a whole plethora of your DNA ancestry.com analysis, which turns out you find very different things about your past and your culture.
So here is I'm a huge advocate, as you know, for freedom of speech on a variety of levels. This is one of the tenets, I believe, that is so important to being a human being, because we learn through hopefully our practice of right speech. We do not we are not able of accomplishing right speech unless we have freedom to commit not right speech. And also, it is really important to be able to unearth and look at honestly all that is within the makeup of what it means to be human, not only the good, but also the bad, and yes, the ugly. If we do not bring it into the light, if we do not look at it, and look at it dispassionately, then it is going to seek expression at altogether the wrong times. You do not feed it, it actually does get hungry and attacks. Now, you do not want to give aid and comfort and nourish that which is ugly and destructive, but you have to form a relationship to it, so it must be expressed. And this is why we ought to protect this kind of freedom of speech, even when it's something that we find distasteful. Now, there are limits on freedom of speech. It cannot be an incite to violence, hence the limitation of yelling fire in a crowded theater. Barring that,
hate speech,
it needs to be protected. Now, is there a huge problem when we have our police protecting it so nobly, and yet at the same time we assign our police to shoot rubber bullets at Native Americans standing up for their rights at Standing Rock? Well, yeah, that might be a bit of a contradiction we want to look at. But yes, we want to protect this this speech. At the same time, freedom of something does not mean freedom of responsibility.
And we said this many times.
We take responsibility for our actions, for our speech. And I'm not one about blame. I'm one about responsibility. And this is where although I see the points that could be derived from what the president said, when you start out by saying there's enough blame to go around, unless he's speaking about himself, which would be to make himself a credible messenger, to take a position of leadership, unless he's talking about himself, then you are wrong, sir. When it comes to an act of violence in our society, yes, we all share responsibility, each and every one of us, because each and every one of us has a role in creating a peaceful society and in preventing violence, which is any act, energy, or force that injures, harms, and destroys from taking place. Letting people know, letting people express this stuff, and sometimes just expressing it can actually diminish it. We know this, that sometimes we express our worst feelings, and what happens in the immediate aftermath? We regret saying it, and we wonder how we could have ever felt it. But it took getting those words out in front of our own eyes to say, wow, okay, I had some real toxicity inside me.
Yes.
And I now have the opportunity at least to form a relationship to it. But we need to hold people responsible. We need to hold the feet to the fire. We need to be able to say, we hear you, we see you, we are watching you, and we will not allow you to injure, harm, or destroy our fellow man or the fabric of our society. And this is where the counter protests come into play, letting them know that they will be shadowed, they will be seen, they will be observed. But that is a far cry from trying to push those people you disagree with into violence. And there is an emphasis on the part of some in the counter protest movement to try to instigate violence, to engage aggressively and violently. And I take great exception to that, because that itself at times is an attack on free speech.
Well, and also, you know, in a leadership vacuum, this power then is up for grabs, technically. And this is the problem that then exacerbates in the internet. If you look at the latest in NRA advertising, that your freedoms are being taken away and there's no leader that can protect them. So the only NRA is your only option to maintain your very freedom of speech, your, you know, and then once you have that as a diametric, as your polar opposites that you either give up or you fight, then now you have to unravel a mentality even to get back to a place where a dialogue can take place.
And this is where responsibility lies, again, as you said, with leaders and also with the media. If you ignore something, that which you ignore actually might not grow because you're not putting your attention to it. But ignoring something is not healthy, because, again, it becomes actually more threatening. You need to shine a light on it, a dispassionate light, and you need to address it. And that responsibility, I think, when it comes to these hate groups, was abrogated, again, by media, by our leaders. So you're right, that frustration then leads to this occasionally violent counter-protest movement.
Right.
Because the people who ought to take the first responsibility for it are abrogating it.
Well, and you say the media, and yet we just had a conversation of how network television's in a scramble just to find eyeballs. I mean, what is the media now? It is my iPad. It is my little screen on my phone where I'm confined. Any echo of any idea I have revert back to me over and over again. So I'm going, oh, yeah, look at the media. It totally agrees with me by the websites that I choose to go to. And I don't try to shine a light into the unknown. The fear that I fear the unknown, that message isn't getting to me. That Harvey Milk guy who's trying to enlighten has the same problem that Fox and NBC has, which is why they come back to the X-Files and Will and Grace, is that we need something that's already in the psyche for eyeballs and just to be heard amongst the information blizzard that we're in. And now, you know, I hear your overall idea being correct, and yet the practicalities of that in this day and age of our mental health declining because we go to bed with an iPad, it seems now something that only turning off the iPad and going out onto the sidewalk and talking to somebody straight in a socialized and just a basic social interaction seems not intractable.
Because
but,
it's our personal responsibility to do so. Responsibility, our ability to respond and not react and not be taken by the things around us. Our personal responsibility.
Absolutely.
And so back to my overall thesis, which you just proved, the responsibility for the violence in Charlottesville lies with each and every one of us. That's not to say that we are to blame. It's not a blame game. We all have responsibility in this. And as you said, it's to get out of our comfort zone, to get out of those safe spaces. And what's so odd is that our safe spaces are so often positions of powerlessness, fear, anger, defensiveness. But it's what we know, so we seek to preserve it, because the unknown is more terrifying. And
this is why everybody should take improv classes. It's learning not to fear the unknown. It's you step into out of your comfort zone into what happens next, and you breathe and you find not just grace but comedy through that moment. I'm teaching improv classes. That's going to happen.
You may find not just grace, but will. Will and Grace. Ah, what happened there? Hey,
bingo.
With so much that we're not getting to today, should we start next? We've got like 10 minutes left.
Oh my gosh, really?
Yeah. We have movies I wanted to discuss, but maybe we'll wait for next week. But we definitely have celebrity deaths and live event that I want to share with you. Which would you prefer to do first?
Let's start with celebrity deaths.
Celebrity deaths.
Sir Bruce Forsyth died at 89. Who was Sir Bruce Forsyth, Dean Haglund?
The guy from the BBC.
Yes.
The great entertainer. He was a beloved music hall fellow, wasn't he? Didn't he start his days in the music hall?
He had recently become best known as the host of the dance competition series Strictly Come Dancing, Strictly,
right,
as it's known to the kids there in the UK. Good work, kids. And he hosted many game shows, including The Generation Game, Play Your Cards Right, The Price is Right. He was a man of many catchphrases. He actually was the highest paid TV personality in Britain, a career that spanned 70 years. He was born in 1928, and he learned to tap dance at a young age, began performing as Boy Bruce, the Mighty Atom, at 14 years of age. He began hosting in 1958, Sunday night at the London Palladium, a variety show that became a huge hit, drawing 10 million viewers there in the UK.
Good Lord.
And it was during that time that he became Britain's highest-paid TV entertainer. Over the following decades, like I said, hosted a lot of game shows. 1970s big hit, The Generation Game, which had 20 million viewers at its peak. He also acted occasionally. He was in Disney's Bedknob and Broomsticks, and even guest starred on the big hit here, Magnum P.I.
That guy got around.
Yeah. He retired in 2013, shortly after being knighted by Queen Elizabeth II in 2011.
The BOE.
Now, you know, I love the character actors, and one of the character actors that would turn up in a lot of movies I kind of liked in the 1980s was an actor of Native American descent, Sonny Landham.
Ah, yeah. From Predator.
Yeah, died of congestive heart failure at 76. It's so shocking to see these ages on these people because, you know, the last time I know I watched them, they were so young. And then I realized, so was I. He was of Cherokee and Seminole ancestry. He played the Native American tracker, Billy Soul, in Predator, in the original Predator. He had a great role that I loved. He was so scary in 48 Hours, which is one of my favorite action movies, one of my favorite comedies. If people have never watched it and wonder whether Eddie Murphy could have been a great actor, watch that. I mean, him and Nick Nolte in 48 Hours.
So
just amazing.
Loose in that thing.
A couple other 80s marginal hits, Action Jackson and Lock Up. What I did not know until he died was that he got his start in pornographic movies during the 1970s.
And, I did not know that either.
Apparently they were of the same-sex variety, if what I read is true. If what I watch is true. His first
research.
Phil, why do you have these subscriptions to these Muscle Man magazines? always looking for suspects. All right, his first role in a traditional movie, I guess we could call it, was as a cop in Walter Hill's cult film, The Warriors, in 1970.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Now, this guy, interesting life. During the 2000s, he became involved in politics. Did you know that he ran for governor of Kentucky?
I did not know that. I did know he was getting into politics from Fox Legal, of all things.
Well, he was inspired, apparently, to run for governor of Kentucky in 2003 because his two Predator co-stars, Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jesse the Body Ventura, had done it. So why not Sonny Landham? And then people said, who? So he did not. His bid came up short to become governor. In 2008, he ran as a Libertarian for the U.S. Senate seat held by Mitch McConnell, very much in the news these days. But controversial remarks he had made about committing genocide against Arabs in retaliation for the 9/11 terror attacks led the Libertarian Party to drop him from the ticket.
Well, good thing.
So Sonny Landham, interesting life. It'd be fascinating to see a kind of a film or something about that guy's life.
Yeah, because, you know, I knew his story in Fox Legal was the Predators toy series that was put out by Micronauts. If you remember Micronauts.
Oh, I loved Micronauts. I love them.
Yeah, they were tiny. They were like less than a millimeter or two in size per toy. And the Predator kit, of course, had a Predator the size of your fingernail, perhaps. And then each of the successive characters after that were maybe half fingernail size. So there were these tiny little things that now I think are choking hazards and probably not for sale anywhere. However, Sonny had them recalled because he didn't like his likeness on this tiny half fingernail version of himself. He thought the likeness was inaccurate. So he actually got a lawyer and had them pulled the entire Predator Micronaut series to have the Sonny character redone to his liking. So, you know, when you're upset at the half fingernail size depiction of yourself, then you're a funny guy.
Speaking of funny guys, Dick Gregory, the legendary stand-up comedian and civil rights activist who I used to see at the Directors Guild all the time, died in Washington, D.C., age 84. I mean, not what's interesting is that, you know, he truly is legendary as a comic. And yet his legend as a comic is overshadowed by his legend as a civil rights activist.
Yes.
And, you know, when he first made an appearance on The Tonight Show with Jack Parr, he agreed only to perform if Parr agreed to interview him after his stand-up act, as early as 1962, because he wanted to talk about civil rights issues. He was born in St. Louis in 1932. He began, as so many African-American comics did, by playing the African-American club circuit. And at one of those shows, Hugh Hefner caught his act, and noting the crowd's enthusiastic response, as well as appreciating Gregory's clever material, he booked him to appear at the Playboy Club in Chicago. And people don't probably remember this, but there was a huge circuit of Playboy Clubs. And so when Gregory became a hit at the club, he then was able to find himself performing for white nightclub audiences. And again, at a time when there were few African-American comics doing so. And he was always socially conscious, and he always applied his fame, like I said, as a civil rights activist. He spoke at Selma in 63. He became involved in protests against the Vietnam War. He became an advocate in the 1970s for nutrition and health-conscious lifestyles.
I didn't know that.
This eventually is what led him to quit performing in nightclubs in 1973, because he said by performing, the performers are giving their tacit approval to lifestyles that include alcohol abuse and smoking. And he wrote many books, many of which are very funny, many of which are very insightful and interesting. It was very interesting. He would appear on InfoWars after 9/11, as a big supporter of 9/11 truth. He even conducted a hunger strike in support of the 9/11 truth movement. So another fascinating man whose life story really ought to be told so that more people know about it. Dick Gregory, dead at 84. So I had a fascinating live event I wanted to tell you about. A place that I'd been before, but we're out of time. So we'll save that for next week. We'll then promise, as long as the world just can avoid some of this violence, as long as these celebrities can stay alive, we'll talk about a whole lot of movies. About your shooting there, shooting. That sounded violent. About your acting performance. Your acting, you're not using film. You're not using film. We can't say that anymore. Your acting performance there in
being recorded.
You're lensing. Medium. Lensing. I like that as a phrase. Yeah.
Yes.
I always enjoyed that as a cinematographer, you know, as Phil Lernis lensed that movie. And so we'll talk about that. We'll talk about movies.
Yep.
We'll talk about the live event. And maybe even we'll touch on something that we've touched on before. And it relates back to, I think, some of the points that have been made this week. But you've heard me say this before. This country, America, is really overdue for an honest conversation about the Civil War, and and there's ways in which it's still revealing itself to to be ongoing, and and you know it coming to a head surrounding these statues. Robert E. Lee is such an interesting figure. I've learned a lot about Robert E. Lee. Again, the good, the bad, the so-called ugly. It might surprise many people to know that Robert E. Lee voted against secession, that he was offered the leadership of the Union armies. But he turned it down because he first and foremost considered himself a loyal son of Virginia. People have argued, economists have argued quite effectively that... that although slavery as an economic system was doomed to failure within a decade because it was going to be replaced by automation in its own way, by equipment and modern techniques.
The cotton gin, yeah.
Yeah. That the war was nevertheless one of the South feverishly trying to defend the economic system of slavery. And who am I to argue with these brilliant economists? At the same time, you have these figures like Lee, you have figures like others who historically voted against secession. And yet they fought for the South because what is not to be completely ignored is that for many people in the country at that time, and perhaps still, their identity is with community first. State second, and national government down the list. Not a federal identity, but a state identity or community identity. And maybe this is the conversation that we could have. What power do we want in our communities? What power do we want in our states? What power do we want? That's a conversation that is worthy of being one that is taken up by every generation, that is being taken up all the time, maybe even in every election cycle. And what role do we have in our communities? What freedoms do we need, therefore? What empowerment do we need? How much or how little do we need a federal government? These are worthy conversations to have, and they don't need to be had over a musket. And for the sake of all those people who fought and died in the Civil War, for crying out loud, 150 years later, we ought to be able to have a reasonable conversation about that. So how may... the events of the last week inspire that conversation, and what can we learn from them? I would like to have that conversation next week with you, Dean Haglund.
Well, I would like that too. That would be fun.
Okay, so that brings us to the end of another, I hope, interesting installment of We Do Talkin'. You can find every installment of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour at chilpackhollywood.com. You can download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
Write a review, why don't you?
What could be more fun? Follow us on Twitter and Instagram, right, Dean?
We're at the exact same handle on both. We are at Dean and Phil, write out the word and. And where are we on Facebook, Phil?
Facebook.com/ChillPackHollywood. When you're not too busy poking things and playing Candy Crush Saga, like us. Won't you? Please?
Please do.
Finally,
yes,
write us.
We'd like to be liked.
We love to hear from you at ChillPackHollywood@yahoo.com. Until next week, this is Phil Lernis.
And this is Dean Haglund. I'll be coming to you back down under.
Oh, next week. Wait, that's right. All right.
Yes, yeah.
Okay. And I'm looking forward to getting a video from you, Dean.
Yes. I'll work on it.
All right. I'll talk to you later.
Okay, man. Bye.
Bye. We'll be right back.
belated spoiler alert.